From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Do you have enough friends?
That's a tough question.
Well, it turns out a lot of Americans don't. More people report feeling lonely these days. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy says we are in the midst of a loneliness epidemic, but making a new friend as an adult, it can be hard. How do you do it and hold on to the ones you already have? We'll get advice from psychologist Marissa Franco, author of the book Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Email us about how you made new friendships in adulthood or why you think it's hard to do at studio2@whyy.org.
My advice is to just start a radio show with someone like Cherry Gregg.
And then have become friends, right?
We're also okay. So I got to shift tone here. Shift tone quickly. We are also going to head down the shore later in the program to talk about rip currents, which are no laughing matter. Just last weekend, 12 teens had to be rescued from a beach in Ocean County, New Jersey.
Time for that serious conversation later. Coming up in a few minutes, our own Peter Crimmins tells us about plans for turning the first bank building right here in Old City into a new museum. But first, Avi, we're going to catch up on this news. You got the shovel, because you know I like to say shovel. Dig in.
Thank you. we had noticed this. We were talking about this actually around the metaphorical campfire, our offices, about how there's all these mergers and closures in local higher ed institutions recently. And Jordan Levy, a WHYY's Billy Penn, did a fantastic roundup that explains some of the underlying causes. But if you've kind of missed this story, recently we've seen mergers, Thomas Jefferson merging with Philadelphia University. We've seen Salus University and Drexel, St. Joe's, University of Sciences. Cabrini recently closed. Their campus was bought by Villanova. That's not really a merger. But under all of this is the fact that enrollments are down. Lots of small schools are struggling. Endowments are dwindling. And if you want to read more, I do encourage folks to check out Jordan's story at billypenn.com because it gets at some of the root causes. This is something that's not going away.
Yeah, and I think about this because my oldest nephew just said he has decided not to go to college, instead to opt for a certificate program. Mm. And a lot of kids have been making that decision not to go to higher ed, citing high the expense.
Yeah.
They don't want student loans. And we see student loans just dealing with the U.S. Supreme Court, no forgiveness there on student loans. So a lot of kids don't want to do it. The pandemic is a big reason. A lot of them don't want any more classes and all those things. And so there's just so much going on with shifting attention from young people. And so it's a big struggle.
And there are the sort of demographic currents at play, because obviously there are bumper crop generations, and then there are generations where there are just fewer people.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's all very fascinating.
And
we had talked about maybe doing a show about it at some point.
I definitely think we should, because it's
maybe
a big
Jordan on.
A big conversation. And speaking of, universities, higher ed, I mean, state school funding is in the headlines right now. Last week, Harrisburg lawmakers, they once again rejected funding for state-related universities. We're talking Penn State, Temple, Lincoln University, and Pitt. Republican lawmakers in the House, they blocked a bill that asked for an increase in funding, over $600 million, right? The funding requires a two-third vote in both the House and Senate, and the Democrats only have a one-vote majority in the House. So Republicans say they want universities to commit to a tuition freeze. They also want more spending transparency. The schools right now are not subject to open record law, so you don't know how they're spending their money. And Freedom Caucus Republicans, they also raised issues. They want to limit free speech on campus. And I mean, that's a big deal for them. And some of them claim that Penn State affiliated health centers work with other healthcare facilities that provide puberty blockers, right? We're talking about trans health here. So lots of little points and counter issues related to this. But right now, that extra money would provide in-state tuition discounts and lower tuition costs. And so it could provide, it could be a huge impact if this budget increase does not get passed.
At the center of this, two Pennsylvania quirks, really.
Mm-hmm.
The first is this idea of state-related universities. I don't know if everyone follows higher ed closely enough to understand. There are two types of schools in Pennsylvania. There are state schools that are run by the state in a more traditional way, and there are these state-related universities that are basically private schools that get some state money. So that's Penn State, Temple, Lincoln, and Pitt. And so the other quirk that we run into here is this two-thirds thing, where you need a two-thirds vote to pass the annual spending subsidy for these four schools. Well, two-thirds.
That's a lot.
That's hard to do in a very divided legislature. Mm-hmm. And so these pet issues, some of which you listed, can crop up as obstacles to getting the money across the finish line. Not the first time this has happened. It's happening again this year. But it is just sort of, and it's an entrenched issue because, again, these two quirks, the very special designation around these schools and also the way the money is approved is unusual.
Yeah. And in the interest of full disclosure, I am, Temple alum, as are a lot of folks around. So this is something that hits close to home for a lot of folks. And we'll see what happens. I mean, we'll see if the lawmakers can get this done.
Wanted to bring our attention quickly to a very interesting story in Philadelphia Magazine by an author named Matthew Corfidge. Matthew, I'm sorry, I don't know Matt. I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation of Matt's last name. But it was a great story. Shout out, Matt. It's about the decline of neighborhood bars in Philadelphia. You may have noticed a lot of, the corner bars, not in Center City, not in the ritzy areas.
The neighborhoods.
And the neighborhoods are struggling or closing down. Obviously, the pandemic has some role there. But one of the other big problems is the cost of a liquor license in the state of Pennsylvania. We have unusual rules here that date back to really the era just after Prohibition. Mm-hmm. There was I'm going to get my history high horse here. There was a governor of Pennsylvania at the time who was a fan of Prohibition. When they ended Prohibition, wanted to make it hard for people to get liquor licenses. So there are these artificial caps on liquor licenses. And as a result, they are now very, very expensive. They have become more so recently because there are new players in the game. This is a recent phenomenon in Pennsylvania that grocery stores and convenience stores, certain ones, are able to apply for and get liquor licenses. They challenge state law. Now, they got a lot of money. Wawa's got a lot of money. Wegmans has got a lot of money. So some of them have been able to get into the liquor license game, which is driving the demand upward. They have a lot of resources, mm-hmm. and it's making it harder and harder for your little neighborhood bars to survive. And so it was a fascinating story. It gets at some deeper issues. It gets at fundamental economics.
Yeah.
But the net result is that we are losing some of these bars that help define the character of little pockets around the city.
Yeah, and I think about my favorite bar that used to be in Old City, Pharmacia. It was around, I think, at least 2 decades or close to 2 decades, and they closed up during the pandemic, and I used to go there and get a cucumber martini after work. It was my spot.
Martini.
Yeah, and I just think I was so sad, and they had a great crab omelet on the weekends. And so I just think about, the closure of that bar. Uh-huh. It was a really cool after work spot. And we did a little roundup about New Jersey actually working to open up liquor licenses to kind of fix this problem. Maybe we'll see something like that in Pennsylvania. But as we wrap up our news roundup, I got to cheer you up. Today is 7-Eleven.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Did you know?
Today is 7-Eleven.
July 11th.
Got it. Okay.
And it's 7-Eleven.
Okay.
Which is 7-Eleven Day. And there's free Slurpees from that convenience chain.
Oh, nice.
Yay. I want to have some claps or something.
Sure. Yay. Free Slurpees. Thank you.
I don't know if people like this or like that, but there is some cool Slurpee history.
Good participation there.
The owner of another familiar franchise, Dairy Queen, created the Slurpee by accident in Kansas City. When his soda machine broke down, he put bottles in the freezer, creating the first Icy.
And you know where that fact is from?
Well,
do you know where that fact is from?
Let me know. Let me know.
It's from a book about the history of ice.
Which
we're going to have the author on later this week. Actually, 7-Eleven. I'll spoil this part. 7-Eleven started as an ice house. It was a place for people to stop and get ice along the road. Then they sort of, as that became less relevant because people got refrigeration, they morphed into 7-Eleven. So the book is full of fun history.
Little
like
pieces
that.
Like that.
Some not so fun history too. But we're going to talk about it later this week. We thought it'd be a good topic on a very hot week here in Philadelphia to talk about the history of ice, which is fascinating. I'm not a big Slurpee guy myself. I would get it if it was
wild
free.
Wild cherry for me.
Wild hint, cherry? Hint.
Yeah.
Because of the name or just because you like
it? Just because I like wild cherry, Avi.
Oh, got
Come
it.
On,
I'm sorry. Did I offend?
No.
Okay. But I don't remember what my favorite Slurpee flavor is. It's been a while.
We
used to get them in seventh grade. Okay. Sure. Me and
friendship.
You. Because we're friends now.
Yes. We're friends. Yes. We're going to get Slurpees.
Okay.
So
shall we shift from Slurpees to...
the firsts.
Yes, to firsts. Yes.
From Slurpee to first. Philadelphia is home to a lot of firsts, in case you didn't know. The first hospital, first zoo, first library, thanks to Ben Franklin, and the list goes on. And it includes the first centralized bank. It was built in 1797. It's an old city. It's been out of operation for decades, and now it's getting an exciting revamp. And here to tell us the story of the first bank and what's next is Peter Crimmins, arts and culture reporter for WHYY News. Hey, Peter, welcome
back.
Hi there.
We're actually home to the second national bank as well. We have the first and the second bank.
Ooh.
Who got the third?
That's outside the city lines.
I'm Philly. So, first things first, this bank was an attempt to establish how we set up our nation's economy, and there was some friction there. Can you tell us?
This is Alexander Hamilton's bank, famously of the musical.
Yes.
Tell
us the story.
Alexander Hamilton wanted to establish a central bank, mostly to help the country out of debt. From the war, the Revolutionary War, right after we won the war, we went into a pretty significant financial crisis because didn't have the commerce and we didn't have any loans and we owed a tremendous amount of money to the French. So Alexander Hamilton wanted the government to establish a credit. He wanted a credit line from the government, and we needed a place to collect and reserve tax revenue, and wanted to loan money back to the government. And so he actually tried to do this earlier, creating the Bank of North America, mm-hmm. which was deemed unconstitutional. So then he gave it another shot with the first bank, what became the first bank of the United States. Pushback from Jefferson and Madison, Southern delegates, who did not like the idea of the federal government getting into the idea of loans and interest rates. They were very involved with an agrarian economy down in the South, and they were opposed to the North. I mean, Alexander Hamilton was from New York, who was a very industrial and a banking economy. And they were very concerned that the federal government would get involved in sort of profit-making and corruption and the things that banking...
So Hamilton wins in the short term, establishes the bank, doesn't last very long.
20
right?
years.
20 years.
He won a 20-year charter. George Washington, as president, signed a 20-year charter. And then after 20 years, they didn't renew it. So 1811, the bank was over.
But it's a fabulous building.
Yeah.
And the
building
still exists. So what happened to the building? And tell us a little bit about the architectural legacy of the building.
Well, the building is a classic Parthenon. It's called a Federalist style, which is derived heavily from the Greek temples. And it really established banking architecture for the next 200 years. I mean, the classic bank, the columns, the triangular, portico on
top.
They
got it from this bank.
This bank set the tone for what banks should be. And the facade is still, I talked to the architect who was involved in the renovations. The bank is, the building is solid. They have to, put a new roof on, put new systems inside of it. But it's been standing for, 225 or so years.
Yeah, and so we're going to get a new museum here thanks to some money. How much are we talking here, and what will this do to this building?
It's a museum of the American economy.
Yeah.
It's a building a museum about the economy. And the lion's share comes from the federal government. I'm blanking on the act, the Great Outdoors Act,
yes.
2020 Great Outdoors Act. They're getting about $22 million just from that. They're getting a few more million from other federal streams, about $10 million from the state through grants, through redevelopment grants, and private donors. They're working on raising $10 million through private donors. So far, they've raised a little more than four. They got some left to do. So in the end, it'll cost about $50 million to renovate the building, establish, a museum, exhibitions, and create a very small endowment.
And they're thinking, what, 2026?
They want to get ready for the 2026, the
250th.
The
semi-quincentennial.
Semi-quincentennial. Yeah, I didn't know what the term was. Thank you. I just learned something.
And can we see these designs somewhere?
The designs for the...
museum.
No. The designs don't exist yet. We have an idea of what's going to be in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No one has been inside this building. The public has not been inside this building for 50 years.
Oh, wow.
It has not been accessible. It's been used as sort of back-end operations by the National Park Service. This is all a National Park Service project, by the way. They've owned the building since the 50s.
Wow.
And so I got to have a sneak peek and get in there and look at it. It's a gorgeous interior, big glass-domed rotunda. It's going to be a really fabulous little museum.
Fantastic. I'll be first in line, 2026. Peter Crimmins.
Looking forward to it.
WHYY's arts and culture reporter. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Cherry, what do we got?
Making friends as an adult. How to overcome that awkwardness and make connections at any age. Stick with us, lots to come. Looking forward to it.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, I am so excited about today's topic. Mm-hmm. We're talking about adult friendships.
I know you're very excited about this topic.
Yes.
I could feel that. In part because you have made, we were talking about this earlier, mm-hmm. some really meaningful friendships in your 30s. And I just wanted to set like a nice tone here. How did you end up making friends in your 30s? Because that's really tough.
Yeah, well, I went through some really tough times and I had acquaintances, should I say. And then when I went through a tough period, I looked up and they really supported me. And I looked over and I'm like, at brunch one day, and I'm like, I love you, you know? And these are like my true friends. And I feel very blessed. We travel together. We hang out. We go to brunch. Lots of brunches because that's our favorite meal.
With the crab omelets.
Yeah,
right?
With the crab omelets and mimosas and all that. And, you know, we talk on the phone. Like, it's just a wonderful addition to my life. And I have friends from that are very old friends from like school. But having newer friends, too, it's been invaluable.
Yeah. It's so interesting. And the fact that a period of stress is what made it possible.
Yeah.
Now, I'm guessing our guest today is not going to tell people to go through life struggles to make friends. But I'm guessing there are some lessons we can glean from that. Because, look, a lot of folks are struggling to find friends.
Yeah.
There are studies that show people living in the 2000s had four fewer friends than someone living in the 1990s. It's really hard to create meaningful adult friendships like the one that you have, mm-hmm. Cherry. And so we're going to bring in an expert today to help us out. Marissa Franco is a psychologist and professor at the University of Maryland and the author of Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Welcome to Studio 2, Marissa.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and we're excited to have you. And while we cannot take calls today, we do want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have questions about making new friends as an adult or rekindling an old friendship? Email us at studio2@whyy.org. You can also tweet at WHYY, and please use the hashtag Studio2.
Marissa, I wanted to start by establishing for folks who are listening out there and maybe struggling to make friends that they are not alone. You had a piece in the Globe and Mail, I believe, talking about how it's harder to make friends these days. Can you lay out your argument for us?
Yeah, so friendship networks have been decreasing for decades now, since about the 1950s. Mm. And what happened in the 1950s? That was in Bowling Alone. Robert Putnam explores this really well. That was the creation of the television. Before the television, we spent our leisure time around other people, and then we started to spend it in our four walls. And the television triggered this lethargy where we're just like, we don't want to do anything else. I call it the plop effect. You plop down on the couch and you don't get off. But then around 2012, we started to see more peaks in loneliness. And what was happening around that time was the creation of the smartphone. It became very, very widespread. And what we've seen happening is that the smartphone has displaced in-person interactions. That, you know, in the past, when people might have had that time with themselves, they might use it to reach out to other people. But, you know, social media apps are giving us this pseudo sense of connection, wherein it's like we're continuously snacking but never getting the full meal of connection. And that's happening to everyone around us. So the people that would have reached out to us are now doing the same thing. And so it makes connection really, really difficult. I think connection now is harder than it has been in human history. And I wrote Platonic because I believe that while society makes connection really hard, there's possible ways that we can swim upstream against that.
Yeah. And before we talk about how to make these connections, I just want to lay the foundation here, because in the world of social media, we have these things called friends online, right?
Yeah.
But I want us to just sort of define what constitutes a friendship. What is a friend?
Yeah. Well, I have a unique definition of this. I mean, if you look into the research, you'll see things like it's voluntary, you like each other, you trust each other more than a stranger. So those are a couple of things. But I define you know, the difference between good friend and good company. So often we think of, some people think of someone as a friend if they enjoy their company and they like them. But to me, that's good company. A good friend is someone who's invested in you, who shows up in your times of need, who supports you in your positive moments, who's committed to working through things with you. It's an investment and it's commitment and it's effortful. And I think a lot of us think that friendship should be passive and think that friendship should be organic. And I think that really gets in the way of our ability to make and sustain powerful friendship.
All right. So where do we start? I want to make a friend. I want to make friends. I'm an adult post-college. You know, I have a job. Maybe I work a little bit in person, a little bit at home. Where do I start?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So I often suggest that people join something that's repeated over time. So not like a happy hour, but like a professional development group, or not like a book lecture, but a book club that meets monthly or weekly. And the reason that I tell people to do something that's repeated is because you capitalize on something called the mirror exposure effect. And that is our tendency to like people who are familiar to us. Mm-hmm. Research finds that when women were planted into a psychology lecture at the end of the semester, none of the students remembered any of the women, but they liked the woman who showed up for the most lectures 20% more than the woman who showed up for the least. So if we commit to some sort of group to show up, you know, for about 3 months before we quit, because what the mirror exposure effect means is that it's going to be uncomfortable at first. Connection is inherently uncomfortable. Our brains predispose us to feel weary and mistrusting of new people. The problem is a lot of people think that that's a sign that they should eject from connection rather than part of the process of connection. The other thing that I suggest is that, you know, when you're around other people, sometimes we engage in something called covert avoidance, which means I'm showing up physically, but checking out mentally. I'm on my phone. I'm in the corner. I'm talking to the one person I already knew. And it's not just about showing up around people, but it's about engaging with people when you get there. You have to say, you know, hi, my name is Marissa. How have you been enjoying this? If you find someone you like in the group, you have to say to them, hey, it's been so nice to connect with you. Would you be open to meeting after this event or meeting before this event? You know, I think a lot of us think that friendship is something that should happen organically, but one study found that people that think friendship happens organically are lonelier 5 years later, whereas those that think that it takes effort are less lonely 5 years later because they make the effort.
And I want to, yeah, and I mean, some people have this social awkwardness. You get nervous around new people.
I
kind of do too, but I push through. And so I want to bring in a comment from Al, who asks, how does fear play into making new friends? How does it hold us up from making new friends? And how hard is it to build trust? And I really want to sort of focus on that fear part.
Yeah.
Because you go in and you feel like, what do I even say to this person?
Or I'm being judged.
Yeah.
Or
you're being, yeah.
Well, I like to tell people on the research about this, because fear, I think one of the biggest impediments to us making friends is this assumption that people just don't like us and are going to reject us. It's this fear of rejection. But what we see in the research is that when strangers interact and they predict how liked they are by one another, they tend to underestimate how liked they are. It's a phenomenon called the liking gap. And so we are liked more than we think. And what we also see is that people that tend to fear rejection, think they're going to be rejected, they actually reject people. They come off as more closed off, more withdrawn, less interested. They go into this self-protection mode, and we don't always realize when we're in self-protection mode, we're actually sacrificing our relationships, because a lot of things we need to do to build relationships rely on us making ourselves more vulnerable, like me initiating, me showing interest, me putting myself out there, me being vulnerable with you, me sharing affection with you. All those things make us more vulnerable, and our fears can really inhibit those things, which is why one thing that I suggest when it comes to making friends is try to assume that people like you. You know, when you're going into a new interaction, remind yourself of that. This is based off of research on something called the acceptance prophecy, which does find that when people are told, even though this is a lie and the researchers were decepting them, but the researcher said, hey, you're going to go into this group and be accepted based on your personality profile in our analysis. It found that people became warmer, open, more friendlier, and it became a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that when we think other people are going to like us, it triggers warm, kind, friendly behaviors that make us more likely to be liked.
It's tough, though, for me, because it almost feels a little conceited to go into an interaction and think, this person likes me. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm more wired
to think, like, yeah, it almost feels like ego, but kind of what you're saying is, you can't think of it that way. I mean, I guess so. Help me out, because that is sort of, I'm a little bit of a nervous person, maybe a little bit neurotic, and it's a little hard for me to get to that place of thinking someone likes me and not feeling like I'm inflating my ego in the process.
You're totally likable.
See, people do like you. I think we get into this place of ego when we think I'm better than other people. But I think we go into this place of openness to give and receive love when we think I am likable and you are likable. Like, we are both equally likable and equally worthy. And realizing that, you know, thinking you're better than people is not going to facilitate connection, because connection doesn't happen on a hierarchy where one person feels superior to another. You know, it makes us hard to be interested and curious about people. And if people feel inferior, it makes them, the fear response kick in, where they're so afraid of rejection. And so it's not about thinking hierarchically about liking, but, you know, but when we assume other people like us, we're fundamentally more likely to be liking towards them, to show more love towards them. So it makes us warmer and it makes us friendlier, which is really different from egotistical behaviors, which are more about being arrogant or acting superior to other people.
And if you just tuned in, we're talking about how to make adult friendships and how to keep them, right? Yeah, yeah. With Marissa Franco, psychologist and author of Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. We want to hear from you. You can email us your question or comment at studio2@whyy.org. Marissa, I met two of my best friends as an adult, and we had actually known each other for quite some time, especially one of them. We knew each other for a while, and then it took us some years, I think, to warm up. And then one day we realized that we were just going deeper in our friendship. And then we were like, wow, like, you're one of my best friends. And how do you sort of open up and to make that deeper friendship and establish that mutual connection? Because a lot of times you keep those relationships very superficial, but it seems like a friend, it would be a little bit deeper.
Absolutely. You know, I think when it comes to being vulnerable with other people, we're so afraid of judgment, but the research is very clear on this. The more we intimately self-disclose, the more liked we are by other people. There is this phenomenon called the beautiful mess effect, which is this finding that when we picture how we come off when we're vulnerable, we think people perceive us negatively. When we picture how other people come off when they're vulnerable, when they admit to mistakes or struggles they have with their body, we see them more positively. That we underestimate how positively people see us as when we're vulnerable. We just think of the judgment, when in fact it's also making us, people perceive us as more authentic. Also, we know from another theory called the theory of inferred attraction that people like people that they think like them. And one way to show that you like someone is to be vulnerable with someone, because it says, I trust you. You're special to me. You know, this relationship uniquely makes me feel safe. And those are all things that create deeper feelings of connection. And so I would say vulnerability is really, really necessary for us to feel close in our friendships. And I think if we're not vulnerable, there's a ceiling to which we believe other people love us, because we're like, they don't really know all of me, but if they do this thing, they might feel differently about me. So I think that's really why vulnerability can really make us deepen our connections with one another.
Speaking of vulnerability, I want to bring in an email from Dan. Dan says, some adults seem to have a ton of friends, a big friend group. Others have one or two really good friends. How do you stop comparison if you're one of those people who don't have a large group of friends? That is a point of vulnerability for a lot of people. We're talking about making friends, but there's also this sort of parallel thing of judging yourself for the number of friends that you have. How do you approach that, Marissa?
Yeah, so the research certainly finds that it's quality connection that matters more than quantity for our happiness. So, you know, if you have close quality connection, that's going to make you happier than if you have a big group of people. The caveat is that around like mid-20s, that's when we tend to have our largest group of friends. As we get older, particularly later in life, we tend to really prune our friendships and try to let go of those friends that aren't within our closest circle. And the reason why that really makes sense is because when we're in our 20s, this is research from Laura Carstensen at Stanford, we're looking to expand our sense of identity and experience novelty and adventure. And that's what we do through other people. They expose us to so many new things, new hobbies, new interests, new ways of presenting ourselves to the world. But as we get older, we start thinking, I only have this much time left. I want to expend it with people that are really meaningful to me. And so what I want to take away from this is that the number of friends reflects our needs at life in a given time. Mm. If we are in a place in our life where we're like feeling really stable and feeling secure and feeling safe, we might want to explore novelty, finding more friends, you know, meeting more people, having that sense of adventure. But when we are in times of difficulty and times of stress, it's those quality connections that are really going to matter. We tend to crave those what's called secure bases, those people that make us feel really close and feel really safe. And so it's not that one's superior to another. It's just that depending on where we're at in our life and what our goals are at a particular time, it might make sense to have a smaller group of friends versus a broader group of friends.
And that, I think, is the perfect transition to this question. There are so many songs where the mantra is no new friends. Mm-hmm. Instead, everybody's like, this person is my day one, my original friend, yes, my OF from back in the day, the folks you grew up with. Is this a reasonable way of being forever, like throughout your life? And if so, why or why not?
Oh, gosh, that is such a funny question. You know, I don't know the psyche of the no new friends, but I will say when we're deciding on relationships, we use three things to kind of decide on whether we want new friendships and new relationships. One is the history we've had with a person, how much we've invested already. So what that means is if I do a high investment behavior with you, like if I travel with you to Spain and I hardly know you, I'm going to be a lot more invested in the friendship. And then the other is how satisfied we are with the relationship, which we think is the biggest predictor of whether we want to hang out with someone is how satisfied we are. But it's actually only one of three. And the third is, do we see ourselves as having alternatives? So if we see that there's no alternatives, we're going to kind of stick to our childhood friends, even if we don't really get along with them. So when it comes to deciding whether to make new friends or not, we tend to weigh these different things. So I could say maybe, based on that theory, it's from Carl Rustfeld, that maybe the no new friends people, they have people that they have long histories with, they may be very satisfied in those relationships, and they may not perceive that there's other alternatives that are as good as the friends that they have now. And if we're at that place, then we tend to have more no new friends behavior.
I want to ask a follow-up question about making friends as a kid versus making friends as an adult, because one thing that you have sort of in your back pocket as a kid is school and certain like regular social functions. So you have exposure to the same people over and over again. And you maybe get some of that as an adult through work, but not quite as much. Is that the reason why it sometimes feels easier to make friends as a kid? Or is it because of just like brain development stuff that's happening as a kid that makes friendship easier? Or is it like a mix of the two? So sort of circumstance versus what's going on in your brain.
Oh, that's a good question. I am not as familiar with the literature on brain development and how it affects friendship, but I am familiar on the research on circumstance and how it affects friendship. Mm. And there's a sociologist, Rebecca G. Adams, and she says for friendship to happen organically, we need repeated unplanned interaction. Like school, we see each other every day, nobody planned it, and we need shared vulnerability. And that's school, that's recess, that's lunch. As we move forward in adulthood, we're working with people, but we're not necessarily vulnerable with them. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some research finds that the more time we spend together at work, the less close we feel. And so what that means for us is that if we assume that friendship should just happen organically like we did in childhood, we're not recognizing we're in a different context now. Yeah. We don't have that same setting which provides us with opportunities. We can't rely on the same assumption that it's just going to happen for us. We need to recreate this experience of having repeated unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability, which is why I tell people who want to make friends, look up a hobby or interest that you can do in community with other people so that you have in your life the same infrastructure that you had when you were a kid that really made it easier to make friends.
Yeah, and I just want to reiterate that with a comment and an email from Shirley, who says she could not make friends on the main line where she is living. And during the pandemic, she joined an online group talking about music and related hobbies and grew close with those people. She says she may never meet these people in person, but she feels like they are her friends.
That repeated
interaction, even though it's online. So she feels that friendship. And so I want to sort of talk about the intentionality of building a friendship, because you know, is it like dating at all, these platonic relationships that you're trying to build? Do I get all spruced up and get the baby hairs together so I can take out my new friend? How does it work?
You know, it's interesting. I think when it comes for us, yes, we need to be intentional, just like many people are with dating, where they're so intentional about going on apps and really looking for someone to date. We need to be as intentional about friendships. Otherwise, we're going to not have a sense of community. I do think we prioritize different things in friendships versus a romantic partner. I mean, appearance may be pretty important for a romantic partner. But when it comes to making friends, what people prioritize, I thought before I wrote Platonic, was finding someone who's entertaining and witty and fun and funny. Mm-hmm. And what we see in the research is that's actually the least important thing. Mm. And the most important thing people report wanting to in a friend is someone who makes them feel loved and someone who makes them feel like they matter.
It's fascinating. All right, I'm going to ask a question that was posed by an emailer, Paul. It might be outside your bailiwick. So if it is, just let us know. Paul said, making friends in the U.S. is much harder than what he was used to when he was living in Armenia. He says people here are less open-minded and oftentimes have their established close friend circles and are suspicious of strangers. I guess I want to ask, are there differences, do we see differences in data among different countries about rates of friendship?
Or culture even.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a good question. I'm not sure if I can answer this like cross-cultural question. I'm sure that it's right, just anecdotally speaking. I just can't spit up data that supports different rates of friendship across different locations. I will say there is some like unfortunate news, which is like there's been a global increase in loneliness in 2012 because of, you know, access to the smartphone. I think the one country that didn't have an increase was South Korea, where the smartphone was already established before 2012.
That's a little bleak.
Really sad. Yeah, I mean, the thing that I do see cross-culturally that does make a difference is this phenomenon called homohysteria, which in the research is straight men's fear of being perceived as gay, which can really inhibit straight men's ability to make friends, where some men feel like I can't initiate a friendship. They're going to think I want more from the friendship, or I can't tell them I love them, or I can't be vulnerable. All these behaviors that are really normalized in women's friendships, a lot of men feel uncomfortable doing, which explains why, you know, men are half as likely to be vulnerable or show affection to other men. And men's friendships tend to be less strong than women's friendships. But we do see cross-cultural differences in homohysteria. In countries where there's low what's called homosuspicion, which is suspicion that other people might be gay, you know, I guess where, you know, people don't even talk about sexual orientation, there tends to be a lot more intimacy amongst male friendships because that fear isn't hovering over people in the same way.
And when we talk about this gender and friendships, I wonder if I want to talk about our romantic partners a little bit. How do adult friendships help or hurt our marriages or partnerships? And how do you establish, you know, these types of friendships without sort of upsetting your relationship in that way?
This is a great question, because I think sometimes we have this myth that friendship and romantic partnership are at odds. When we spend time with our friends, we're not spending time with our romantic partner. But what we see from the research is that if I make a friend, not only is my romantic partner less depressed, and not only am I less depressed, but so is my romantic partner. We see that if I get into conflict with my romantic partner, it negatively affects my release of the stress hormone cortisol, but not if I have quality connection outside of this partnership. So in fact, friendship facilitates our ability to be in a romantic partnership because we have these little interventions making us happy and grounding us and making us feel like better partners to other people. So I would actually encourage people, if you feel threatened by your partner making friends, that actually it's going to make your relationship a lot better if you encourage your romantic partner to make friends.
We only have like 30 seconds left, though, but just on that point, sometimes it's not so much that my partner would be restraining me, but I would feel guilty about telling my partner, hey, I'm going to go hang out with the fellas right now, and sort of spinning that as a good thing for them. I mean, how do you have that? With 30 seconds, how do you have that conversation with your partner?
I think it's good to have a general conversation, not in a moment where you're like, I'm going to hang out with my friends, but how do we want to balance, you know, the time we spend with each other versus the time we spend with our community? What feels good for us? You know, do we want to find community together with each other's friends? Do we want to do it separate? Just having a larger conversation on how you want to navigate that.
Excellent advice. That is Marissa Franco, psychologist, professor at the University of Maryland, telling us about adult friendships. She wrote a book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Marissa, really enjoyed it. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up, we'll figure out what to do if you find yourself stuck in a ripped current. Loving this music, too.
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Welcome back to Studio 2. Each year, the United States Life Saving Association predicts more than 100 Americans lose their lives to rip currents.
And just this past weekend, 12 teenagers got caught in a rip current at the Jersey Shore near Toms River. Luckily, all of them rescued by lifeguards.
But Avi, it does not always end so smoothly. Last month, a father tried to save his daughter's life, who got caught in a rip current in Avon-by-the-Sea, that's near Asbury Park. The teenager made it out of the ocean alive. Her 39-year-old father was not as lucky. He died.
So what can we do to prevent situations like these? And of course, there's going to be a discrepancy between what you learn today and what you do when you end up in an emergency situation. But even if you're just a bystander, it's important to know what to do and also, more generally, how rip currents work.
And so we thought it would make sense to bring on an expert who works on predicting rip currents and could also help us understand how to stay safe. Greg Dusek is a senior scientist with NOAA's National Ocean Service, and he joins us now. Greg, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, how are you both? Great to be with you today.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. So we want to start first with a basic question. What exactly is a rip current, and why is it so dangerous?
Well, rip currents are seaward-directed jets of water that begin in the surf zone. And they can occur on any beach with breaking waves. And so that means, you know, all of your coastal beaches, as well as the Great Lakes, which some people don't think about. And rip currents can be anywhere from like 50 to 100 feet wide, commonly. They can extend offshore, in some cases, up to a quarter mile. So they can pull pretty far offshore. And they can reach speeds in excess of about 5 miles per hour, which I know to a lot of people, 5 miles per hour doesn't sound that fast. But you know, if you think about Michael Phelps, when he set his world record in the 100-meter butterfly, his average speed was about 5 miles per hour. So,
whoa.
So you know, even if you're a very strong swimmer, they can cause you some problems.
I know we're going to do science on the radio. It's tough. But can you give us a basic sense of why they form, or like what the sort of the preconditions tend to be?
Yeah, so rip currents are really caused by breaking waves.
Okay.
And so really the mechanism that drives them is how waves are breaking along shore. And really it's in places where you have, you know, larger waves breaking in one spot and then smaller waves breaking in another. And that leads to differences in water level. So, you know, when you have big waves, if you've been at the beach, you probably notice you get more water pushed up on shore. And so when you have smaller waves, you have less water, and water wants to flow downhill. So those differences in kind of water levels due to breaking waves along shore sets up that circulation where you have water flowing from these areas of large waves to small waves and then offshore as a rip current. And those will often happen. They can happen for a bunch of different reasons, but kind of the most common is when you have a sandbar near shore. So you have some shallower spots, and then you might have a channel or a deeper spot. And that changes in depth influence how waves are breaking and kind of set up that circulation. And then you can also have rip currents caused by structures like jetties or piers, or sometimes even just, you know, how waves are breaking. You know, if people have been to the beach, you know, you notice that waves don't just always come in the same way. They kind of vary in space and time. And so that can drive rip currents as well.
Yeah. And you've come up with a method of sort of predicting the conditions for rip currents. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah, so just a couple years ago, NOAA operationalized the first national rip current model. And the model is able to predict the likelihood of hazardous rip currents from 0 to 100%, so kind of like a precipitation forecast, And it does that every mile along the beach, every hour, up to 6 days into the future. And so we have that running across much of the continental US. And really that enables us to provide, you know, much more guidance, location specific guidance, time specific guidance. If you're ready to go to the beach a few days, you know, from now or this weekend, you're able to get information that can help you looking those days ahead, and really enables, you know, people to make better decisions about when and where they might want to swim.
And let's highlight this, Greg. Where do people go to find that information right now?
Yeah, so the best thing to do is to go to your local weather forecast office. If you go to weather.gov, you can find that there. If you're not sure about which office is yours and you just want to get to the forecast directly, you can just go to weather.gov/beach. And then you can find your forecast information there. And then also, you know, for people who might follow their local meteorologists local weather, you know, they will often share that forecast information as well. So you can often find that information there too.
Yeah. And so let's talk tips. So I arrive at the beach with my family. I didn't check, you know, but is there a way for me to just get to the beach and see whether or not this could be a problem?
Yeah, so you can see rip currents, but it can be challenging. You know, even for people who have done this for a long time, you know, it's not always the easiest thing. And so, you know, what we tell people is when you show up at the beach, what you want to do is before your natural inclination is just run down. You want to be next to the water. You want to sit down in the sand, enjoy yourself. But once you get down close to the water, you're too close and you really can't see what's happening on the ocean surface. So ideally what you want to do is, you know, when you're coming over, say a beach access, or if there's a boardwalk near the beach, somewhere elevated, kind of removed from the water, you know, take a few minutes and scan the ocean surface and try to look for any hazards. And for rip currents, really what you want to be looking for is again, kind of how waves are breaking along shore, and specifically kind of counterintuitively, actually kind of where waves aren't breaking. Most people I think would be like, hey, I want to go swim where there aren't waves, but that turns out that can actually be a rip current because, you know, in those deeper spots that I mentioned before, kind of those channels in the shape of the bottom, you know, waves aren't breaking there as much. And so if you watch the line of breaking waves for a few minutes, it can often become apparent that, hey, there's this spot where I just don't see many waves breaking. And it might be darker in color. And that can be a good indication of a rip current. And then you also might notice sand or sediment in the water, so discolored water, or foam on the surface of the water kind of being pulled from shore, kind of in a line from shore. So you know, that those are kind of key indicators there. But the best thing you can do when you show up at the beach, ideally, is just to swim near a lifeguard, because, you know, your chances at drowning near a lifeguarded beach are like 1 in 18 million. So, you know, if you're not sure, if you're not confident, if you're not a strong swimmer, it's always the best bet to swim near a lifeguard.
About a minute left, Greg. Just want to hit these square on the head. What do you do if you're caught in a current, and what do you do if you see someone caught in a current?
So if you're caught in a rip current, what you don't want to do is try to swim straight back to shore. That'll just tire yourself out against the current. So you want to relax, float, and then kind of evaluate your situation. If you're a strong swimmer, you want to swim along the beach, kind of parallel to the beach, until you're out of the current, and then back to shore at an angle, kind of following the breaking waves. If you're not a strong swimmer, if you're not making progress, float, wave your hands, call, yell for help. And really, if you just stay on the surface of the water, eventually someone will rescue you. Eventually, you'll get out of that situation. If you see someone caught in a rip current, again, the first thing you don't want to do is just react and run in, which I think is everyone's natural inclination, especially if it's a loved one. But what we tell people is take 10 seconds and think about the situation. If you're at a lifeguarded beach, get a lifeguard. If you're not, call 911 or get someone to call 911, because even if that person gets out, they might need life-saving support. And then look for something that floats. So that can be a boogie board, a surfboard, even a cooler. And ideally, you want to just be able to throw it to them. Because again, if they stay on the surface of the water, they're going to be okay. if you can't do that, they're too far away. The only option is for someone to go in and rescue them. You want to make sure you have that flotation device with you, whatever that might be, because you know that's really the best thing you can do to make sure you don't become a drowning victim yourself.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you so much. That was Greg Dusek, a senior scientist with NOAA's National Ocean Service. Thanks for being on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Our producers today, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Al Banks. For more of our show, head to whyy.org/studio2 or download us wherever you get your podcasts. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today. Hope to see you tomorrow.